You're listening to Culture, first broadcast on January 9th, 2012 on Monocle 24. Culture with Robert Bound, in association with Mercedes-Benz.
Hello and welcome to the lucky 13th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today, we'll be gathered around our metaphorical fire and lounging back in our reading chair as we discuss the art of storytelling, an activity so central to creative endeavour that some might say it's the lifeblood of the practice. Joining me in the studio are John Owen, Head of International Journalism at City University in London, and Joanna Yates, Creative Director and Producer of Spark London, a successful storytelling night, to help me unravel what it takes to tell a story that people actually want to hear.
If you don't know how to tell a story, then you have no future in this business, because there's no role for journalism beyond the kind of noise that's out there if it's not some kind of value-added information.
We'll also be checking in with Ira Glass, presenter of one of the world's biggest podcasts, This American Life, to hear about how he spins out a successful yarn.
And the plot of the story is there's two families in a small town, and when the babies are in the hospital, the babies get switched, and one of the mothers knows it and does nothing for 40 years.
And we'll be getting a special 1 minute of sound from those masters of condensed storytelling, the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
A young boy from New Jersey moves to California, where he doesn't fit in and gets beaten up by bullies when he talks to one of their girlfriends. An elderly Japanese gardener jumps into the fray and beats up the bullies.
Plus, an opening night in what could be Tokyo's tiniest gallery. We get some recommendations from Mr. Dead and Mrs. Free Record Shop in Berlin. And we visit This Land Press in Oklahoma to hear about how they've been bucking the trend and putting their trust in print journalism. That's here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. What a lot to look forward to, isn't there? But first, let's have some music. This is from our album of the week. It's Celestial Electric by AM and Sean Lee, and this track is City Boy.
Sitting back rows with nothing to say. Born in the headphones and running away. You needed someone to turn you around. You could
City Boy by AM and Sean Lee from their new record, Celestial Electric. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. And this week, we're sweeping our search engines aside, turning off our smartphones, and just sitting down with a nice cup of hot tea and a biscuit and listening to a story. Well, not exactly, but we are here to discuss and celebrate storytelling. With me in the studio, John Owen, Head of International Journalism at City University in London, and Joanna Yates, Creative Director of Spark London. Storytelling, Joanna, most relevant to you perhaps to kick off with, maybe more than journalism, is the art of storytelling and having a storytelling night. Maybe you could give us a little bit of history about how and why you started up Spark London, how it works.
Yeah, well, in 2007, I was in the States, and there's a lot of true storytelling in the States. There's obviously the Moth in New York, but there's other events too. And I saw a show, and I went from sitting there going, what on earth is this, to being on the edge of my seat and loving every moment of it. And I came back to the UK, and I didn't even look to see if anyone else was doing it. I just went out and created my own version of a true storytelling show, which consists of between 5 to 7 people telling a true story, first-person story, connected to a theme in front of an audience. To get people ready, I like to find people who aren't necessarily honed performers. So I actually prefer a story from someone who does something completely disconnected from performance day to day in their day to day life. So I do ask them to write it down. But by the time they're on the stage, I get them to tell the story without any notes, 99% of the time. And I think that's really important. And I don't think they're doing it to do with oral tradition. I think they're purely doing it because it gives them an outlet that they wouldn't otherwise have. And because of the positive result they get back from the audience when they actually share something about themselves.
And John, I wanted to bring you in and ask you about storytelling. I mean, as head of international journalism at City University, people might kind of think, well, this isn't about storytelling. They might be tuning into this show and thinking, this is about news, this is about something different. But presumably there is a lot of the art of storytelling in telling news stories, presumably, as well, right?
Well, the big difference between what Joanne's doing, of course, and journalism is that you have to be able to support the facts.
Yeah.
So you need to tell a very good story, engage people, grab their attention, create some kind of flow from the beginning to the end. But you do have to corroborate the facts or do what a writer-editor put in a wonderful book called The Art of Fact. He said you can make the facts dance, but the facts still have to be supportive.
Have to be there in the first place. And do you find, I mean, Joanna, at Spark London, are people relating their experiences with a little bit of perhaps gloss on it that John might shake his head at? Is it very fictional? Are people relaying everyday experiences? We're going to hear a couple of clips in a minute, which sound like they might have been very much culled from reality.
No, they are absolutely all true stories. Uh-huh. What constitutes a true story from your own personal experience is obviously very much filtered through our own personal experience. But they're all true stories, and they're all technically stories. So they have to be something where somebody faced a difficulty, a challenge, had something to overcome, and they came out the other side and they discovered something as a result.
All right. Well, we're going to hear a couple of clips now from a couple of your performers at Spark London. First of all, we've got Habby, and after that, we've got Trevor.
Indian officialdom is well known for its impenetrable inflexibility, but Indians themselves are the opposite. But the whole thing's hopeless because there's only about half an hour left before we both have to leave for the airport in separate taxis if we could ever possibly make this flight. At the consulate, my lover approaches the man giving out the tickets for the queue and explains he has a flight to Bangalore at 1 p.m. Is there any chance of getting a visa in time? The man looks incredulous. Sir, it is not very likely. Actually, it's not at all likely, but let us try. So he leads my lover to the front of the queue and he says, this gentleman has a flight at 1 o'clock. Is it okay if... And they all say, yes, good luck, good luck, good luck.
That was Habby performing at Spark London, and this is Trevor.
But the idea was I would walk, run through the sea and evade the whole police checkpoint. So my friend Ollie goes round. He has the Australian passport. He goes round quite legally. I go into the sea, and there's a big searchlight sweeping across the sea. So I have to wait 3 or 4 times for the searchlight in absolute terror. And eventually, when the searchlight passes, I race through the sea as fast as I can, stumbling all over the place. But eventually, cold and wet, arrive at the other side in Syria. I hide behind a rock, wait for about 40 minutes, shivering. And then suddenly a man approaches me, carrying a gun on his back. It's actually Ollie with his rucksack. And they've refused to allow him through because they say, where's your friend? So we both realise that our situation is very serious because, you know, they know that something's amiss and I've disappeared somewhere.
And they were a couple of guest performers at Spark London, Joanna Yates's storytelling night. We heard some not canned laughter there, some good old-fashioned belly laughs at those stories. How important is humour to telling a good story? Do you find that people, maybe when they stand up, they feel that they have to engage people with a sense of humour? And is that the same in London as it was in New York?
I think humour is important. Mm-hmm. I think truth is the most important for me. And people will sometimes try and make something funny to try and engage the audience. Whereas I think the audience at Spark respond best when they hear the truth. And that may be funny, and it may have a funny spin on it, or it may not, actually.
I suppose humour is a way of breaking the ice for people. Do you think it takes perhaps a little more guts to be able to tell something a little bit more searingly honest than simply funny?
It's... definitely takes guts to tell something searingly honest. And often, through searingly honest, it can be very, very funny, actually. And I've seen that, where somebody has told a story very much in terms of what happened, and without realising, being very, very amusing, and the audience responded with laughing.
Well, I want to let me nice to get down to basics, I suppose, and I wonder what makes a good story. We'll start with you, Joanna. Are there things that always make a good story?
Yes, I think so. There has to be a situation which is like, what's going to happen? Like, what did they do? Did they go right? Did they go left? Mm-hmm. So there has to be a sense of a predicament, essentially. I think that's absolutely crucial. I think a good story starts in the action. There's not too much meandering leading up to it. Kind of starts and it goes wham bam. And I think it finishes sharply as well.
And is that the same for a news story, John? Other than obviously getting the facts down, are there ways of telling something to engage people, whether this is in print or on the television or in any number of media?
Absolutely, absolutely. The best writers, the best broadcasters grab your attention right away. And it could be a dramatic quote. It could be a character that's introduced right away. And then that's the other essential part of it. You must have strong characters. Anybody who's a good storyteller is going to weave around very... very powerful characters. And then, you know, you talked about the pacing. It's the arc, you know, in television and writing terms. You must have an arc. So you must go from somewhere, you must build to something, and then you must end in a kind of persuasive way. That can be a problem in journalism, however, because sometimes you can be so in love with your characters that sometimes you want those characters to be a particular way or right. behave in a certain way, and they don't. And then you're left with a dilemma because the characters don't fill the narrative.
And I wonder, John, whether people, when they sign up to your course and when they're learning how to, you know, be news gatherers and storytellers within the news, whether they go in wanting to, you know, impart the hard facts, and whether they're almost surprised that they end up telling stories.
Well, see, I don't think you can separate good storytelling from good journalism.
Okay.
If you don't know how to tell a story, especially now in a world of 24/7 blogs, tweeting, if you don't know how to tell a story, then you have no future in this business, because there's no role for journalism beyond the kind of noise that's out there if it's not some kind of value-added information. If any of those storytellers aren't with us, then journalism has no future.
I was going to ask you both whether the broadening out of media, the fact that there are more things available to us, we're talking, this is going to be a podcast as much as it's a live streaming radio show. We're talking about storytelling. There are obviously more mediums available to people to get their stories out there. Do you feel that, you know, changes the way that stories are told? I mean, yours are done live, but presumably they're also available as podcasts and things as well. They are on your website, aren't they?
Yes, they are available as podcasts. Yeah, no, I think it does. I think there are so many different ways people are sharing their stories now. And I think the medium, the length of time that you've also got to engage your audience as well changes the way people tell their stories. Mm-hmm. I think there's kind of much shorter forms. A lot of the podcast forms is much shorter. So yeah, no, I think it's definitely a change.
I think the craft remains the same, and the best people practice the craft in the most creative way. And they're the ones who will always have futures. I mean, if you cannot, again, separate the wheat from the chaff, to use the cliche, if you can't figure out who the characters are, if you can't figure out what's really important, if I can't engage your attention, especially, again, in the noise of 24/7 media, then I think it's very difficult to kind of have any kind of career.
And maybe you could tell us quickly, so that people can kind of check out the website and all the rest of it, where they can come and see you.
Our website is sparklondon.com. We have a free weekly podcast, which is available through iTunes, and there's a link on the website to that too. If you'd like to come and see us, we are located at the Canal Cafe Theatre, which is in Little Venice, and we have an open mic version of the show, which takes place in Brixton, which is upstairs at the Ritzy. And we have themes. January in Brixton will be resolutions, so 5-minute stories on the theme of resolutions. The 6th of February in Little Venice will be the theme of unexpected.
Well, Joanna Yates, Creative Director of Spark London, and John Owen, Head of International Journalism at City University, thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. After the break, we'll be back with some more storytelling with Ira Glass of This American Life.
Avant-garde.
Avant-garde. I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary
to see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, before we hear from the dulcet tones of Ira Glass, I'll indulge you in a little more music. This is new from Catalyst, Day and Tonight.
Another day is done, another race is run, and there is no place that makes me feel alive.
No place like home,
no place like home,
no place like home,
no place like home.
No more chilled than Day and Tonight by Catalyst. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, if you've ever been driving around the US, you may have twiddled a knob or two on your car radio and come across a programme that's become the staple diet for fans of American storytelling. This American Life started out as a small radio show in Chicago in 1995 and has since grown to become one of the, if not the, most popular podcasts in the world. Its host, Ira Glass, has worked in public radio since 1978 and knows a thing or two about spinning a yarn. Recently, he spoke to my equally loquacious producer, Katie Bilboa, to explain the show's take on tale telling.
we do stories. Most of them are about regular people, not famous people, usually not things in the news. The idea is to tell stories on the radio in a way that is compelling and fun to listen to. Like, that's our main goal, that they should just be fun to listen to and gripping, you know, and do that in a way which doesn't sound like, you know, 1940s radio drama.
And how do you select these stories? Because presumably people are approaching you, or do you have to go out and find them?
It's a mix of both things, actually. It's a very inefficient process to come up with the stories on the show. For us to find three or four stories in a given episode, we will run at anywhere between 15 and 25 stories, and it'll take us 3 or 4 months. And generally what happens is we have one story that we stumble on that just we love, and we just think we got to put this on the radio, and it doesn't go with any of the shows that we're building at the time. So we'll have that story, and that'll be the anchor for the show, and then we'll concoct some theme for that episode of the show, and then we'll begin to look for other things that would be interesting to paste onto that story as other stories in the show. And so if it's a big, heavy story, then we'll look for things that are lighter and funnier. And then to do that, that's just like a massive process of partly just looking at things that didn't fit into previous shows. That usually takes about a minute. And then after that easy part of the search, we have an email list of about 1,000 people who've either been on the show or we're trying to get them on the show. And we'll send out an email saying, like, have you got anything that could possibly go with this idea? And we're thinking it's, you know, what we need is a business story or a family story, or just something that it's got to have this kind of thing to it. And then we'll usually get back a couple dozen pitches from that. And then, you know, we just do the inefficient thing that reporters do, which is we just start to brainstorm about what else could go with this and start looking for stories along the way.
So how long would you estimate it's taking you to put together one episode of This American Life then?
I would say an average is 3 or 4 months by the time that we have enough things that we think are good enough. And really, we're actively working on it mostly in the last 5 weeks.
When these stories are coming at you, how do you know when one's going to make it?
Well, some stories just announce themselves to you, you know, just because there'll be an interview which just goes so stunningly well that you just know that was great. And that happens. And then there's a lot of stories where it's just like you're just beat on the story and you just rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it and redo it this way and that way. And you're not exactly sure if it's going to work. And really, it won't be up till the last week or two that we know. And we produce more things like for the show than actually make it on the air. We'll go into production on 5 or 6 or 7 different stories and then kill off all but the 3 or 4 that make it on the air. And often it's up to the very last day.
I think it's really fascinating because the show itself is divided into acts. One of the things I wanted to ask you was, how important do you consider your role in telling these stories? You know, how important is the kind of production and curatorial element on top of just a story needing to be a good story in itself?
I mean, the curatorial element, honestly, is such a huge part of it. Truthfully, like, it would be impossible to produce the show if it were just me. I mean, it really is 8 of us, and everybody has a hand in that. And I work closely with one of the producers in particular, my senior producer. Probably half of our time as a staff is spent looking at and evaluating and starting stories just to see if it could work. There's a tremendous amount of the effort is curatorial. And I think, like, when you start to do any kind of creative job, like, one of the things that nobody ever tells you is how much time you're going to spend just looking for an idea that's worth making, you know, your story about, or your music about, or your movie about. Like it's just a huge amount of time just finding something worth saying. And so I would say, you know, we spend like half of our time as a staff just looking for stuff, and then the other half of the time actually making the stories.
And so will there be stories that don't make it sometimes that then you then revisit later on because you realize, oh, actually, you know, you suddenly have one of those moments where you wake up in the middle of the night and think there's another side to it, or you think suddenly, actually, that would fit in really well here instead. Do you have those moments?
Never. No, because by the time we abandon a story, we have beat it to death. Like, we, you know what I mean? Like we're annoyingly aggressive with the stories. And by the time we give it up, like, you know what I mean? Like we have tried everything that a person could do. Like, I can say that, like there are ways in which our staff isn't the greatest staff in the world, but I have to say we are dogged. And if we can't make it into a story on the radio, I believe it cannot be made into a story on the radio.
Okay, well, before I want to move on a little bit to talk about how we tell stories, but I just wonder if there are some favorite examples you have from This American Life of stories that you just thought worked really well or were just really gripping.
We tried to like make up a list of favorites. Switch to Birth is a big one. It's sort of a triumph of storytelling. One of our producers, Sarah Koenig, put that together with a reporter. And I remember when she first played it for us, I was like, I can't believe how ingenious this is. And the plot of the story is there's two families in a small town. And when the babies are in the hospital, the babies get switched. And one of the mothers knows it and does nothing for 40 years. Yeah. Like basically, she knows that her actual biological child is being raised a few blocks away by another family. And the differences between the two families are almost theatrical. One family is dark-haired. One family is fair-haired. One family is sort of brooding and introverted. One family is extroverted and happy. And these two girls find themselves in the wrong families. And truthfully, like, always feel like, God, I'm so different than everybody in the family. And basically, it's a story that we tell over the course of the entire hour. And the trick of the story, in a way, it's a complicated story because you have so many characters. You have both families. You have both girls. You have both mothers. And so how do you lay it out in a way that it'll be compelling? And the way that they do it is that they take it sort of character by character. And what happens is the mom, when the girls are around 40, tells everyone, here's the truth, which completely wreaks havoc in both families because the parents in both families think like, well, will the girl I raised still love me or will she abandon me to go to this other family? And both girls wonder like, is my family that I was raised with that I think of as my family going to abandon me? And it just brings up anxiety on everyone's part, a very, very dramatic. And also this kind of like shock of recognition of like, I knew that I was different than you guys. Though I, truthfully, I think most people have that about their own biological families. Like,
yeah.
I know that. What am I doing here with you people? And then what's so beautiful about the structure of it is that at the end, you finally hear from the mother who was the one who knew, who held back for 40 years, who by that point in the story, you really question her judgment and like, why in the world would you wait 40 years to straighten this out? Like, why didn't you just the day after you got the baby home or before then just switch it back? And she tells her own story in a way where up until that point, she's been the villain of the piece and she completely flips you. You completely end up on her side. It's kind of amazing. And so that's one where what's nice is there's plot twists along the way. And then the final plot twist is that the villain isn't the villain.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you, I mean, obviously when you're a young child and you're writing stories at school, you know, your teacher always says to you, well, in the UK anyway, the teacher says to you, you know, you've got to have a beginning and a middle and an end, and that's how you tell a story. And obviously, as we get older, things get a bit more complicated. But I just wondered, you know, what do you think are the building blocks of telling a story? Is there a formula that you could follow, or is it something that can be taught or learned?
I think there is a formula, and I think it can 100% be taught and learned. I was not a natural storyteller at all, and it's only by trial and error and making stories that I learned it. And we're very much traditionalists on a show. Like, the stories have a beginning, middle, and an end, and you need something at the beginning that's actually interesting enough and exciting enough and new enough and sort of charming enough. If all else fails, if it's not new enough, at least it has to be like completely winning and funny and something to just pull you in. You definitely need like a great hook for the beginning. And then you need a plot. Like, things have to happen to characters. You on the radio, peculiarly, you also need ideas to accompany the plot. You want the characters in the story to reflect on what has happened to them in an interesting way and in an emotional way. On the radio, it just is much more satisfying.
And that's what I wanted to move on to that. I mean, what is it about radio? Because, you know, is there something about the kind of oral tradition of just one person talking to another person, just hearing another person's voice telling a story that has kind of, that is really gripping and that has kind of almost transcended technology and time and still remains the most powerful way of telling a story?
I mean, I don't know if it's the most powerful way of telling a story, but there is something very old about hearing somebody tell you something that happened to them, and they're talking from the heart, and they're talking with emotion, and the intimacy of that is chemical, you know, like it affects us chemically. And when we're editing the stories, we feel it. When there's tape where somebody's talking that way, every time you hear it, you know, you edit something, you listen to it over and over and over again, and every time you hear it, it still feels like something, like it's just built into what we are. Being able to harness that is really important to making the stories work.
I've always been struck by how immediate it can be as a medium.
I think there's something really special and unusual about the intimacy of it. Yeah. Like, the thing I would say is, like, the intimacy of it is built in. We did a TV show for a couple of years, and it's almost like to get that kind of intimacy, it's like you have to construct an entire scaffolding and an artifice, and you just have to move so many huge blocks of things into place and carefully construct it. Whereas on the radio, like, that's the default position. That's what it's doing when it's not trying to do anything.
But I just had one last question I wanted to ask you. Do you think, I mean, is there something about American culture specifically that makes people better communicators and better storytellers?
It could happen in any country. I met somebody from Australia who had moved here, and she was saying to me that she's astonished at how confessional Americans are. She says, like, you meet people at parties and they start talking to you about their childhoods as a way to say, like, here's who I am. And everybody's got, like, their stories. And so maybe there's more of an uninhibitedly confessional part of the culture. You know, we're talking to people about often, you know, the stories that mean the most to them, or at least, like, stories that where they have very, very strong feelings about what happened in these stories. You know, like, that's the story they can tell you, is the story where they have, like, incredibly strong feelings.
Yeah. So maybe that's the key.
Yeah, like, but I don't know. Like, I don't know enough about other countries. Is it true?
Well, I think you do a very good job. But Ira Glass, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
And that was my producer, Katie Bilbao, getting in a bit of the old oral tradition with Ira Glass there from This American Life. What a guy. So to come in part two, we'll be hearing from Oklahoma's This Land Press, a newspaper offering Middle America something unique. We'll attend Tokyo's smallest opening night, and we'll hear a screenplay for a new film that's just 60 seconds long. First, every week we've been aiming to bring you some recommendations from bookshops and record shops around the globe. And while we've eased off over the festive period, we're back now with a bang. We tootled down to Mr. Dead and Mrs. Free, a Berlin institution which opened its doors when the Berlin Wall was still alive and kicking in 1983, to get some recommendations.
Hi, my name is Volker Quante, and I run this record store called Mr. Dead and Mrs. Free together with two other people, Tim and Ina, an independent record store in Berlin. We are located in Schöneberg, one U-Bahn stop from the KDW, and we've been here since 1983, which is quite a long time. It's been a long way for us. We have developed ourselves a lot. We started out as a hip indie store with some own imports from America and from England, and we developed our own taste, and we found a very diverse sort of customer in Berlin. We have young people, older people, and everybody's meeting here, and it's sort of interesting to see how different worlds connect here. We went from vinyl to a little bit CD and back to vinyl again. And we like the development that brought back vinyl, because the people who consume really a lot of music, buy a lot of music, really prefer this format. There was some uncertainty about 10 years ago when collectors were wondering and were out of their heads deciding, I go CD now and I don't want vinyl anymore, but a lot of them came back, and yeah, I think vinyl is the format to stay, and the CD is going to go away for the digital downloads, and that's a development that's very popular with our customers. We have more and more people asking, does it have a download code or not? And sometimes people don't even buy the vinyl because it doesn't have a download code. But yeah, it's fair for the people, because vinyl customers don't always listen at home. They also want to carry their music with themselves. So yeah, the bestseller of 2011, well, it's a tie, I'd say, between the PJ Harvey album. PJ Harvey is a very British artist, but she gets recognized here as well.
I've seen and done things I want to forget. I've seen soldiers fall like lumps of meat, blown and shot out beyond belief.
Black Keys album.
Little black submarines, operator, please put me back on the line. Told my girl I'd be back, operator, please. This is wrecking my mind.
Quite a lot of our customers will be interested in the Stone Roses reunion, I'd say, which doesn't interest me that much, but I think it's something that people are looking forward to. Then the Avett Brothers, an American band, are in the studio again. They have another album coming out this year, produced by Rick Rubin. That's something I'd like to hear.
That was the sound of the Avett Brothers, as recommended by Mr. Dead and Mrs. Free Record Shop near Nollendorfplatz in Berlin. It's time to talk media, and at first glance, 2012 looks like another crisis year for print journalism in the US. Local newspapers are shrinking and content is taking the place of stories as editors cater to the distracted eyeballs of a new generation of readers. So what a relief to hear of a new publication that's creating a beautiful print product, telling stories with text, sound and video as it sees fit, and funneling investment dollars into long-form narrative journalism. And it's nothing short of astonishing that such an experiment is based in Tulsa, Oklahoma. In an area best known for evangelical Christianity and extreme conservative politics, the upstart publication This Land Press doesn't care much for sacred cows. Boldly styling itself as Oklahoma's first new media company, This Land is a long-awaited hub for a growing community of local writers, artists and producers. From Tulsa, Shepard Lachlan reports on the company that's got everyone in Tulsa talking.
Where are we on copy edits or just editing?
It's a rainy Monday morning, and a crew of about 20 staff members and contributors are filing into the office of This Land Press for the weekly editorial meeting. The office in question is actually a converted two-bedroom house, painted barn door red and sporting This Land's logo, a bullseye with Oklahoma's frying pan outline at its center. The meeting room sports funky mid-century furniture and walls papered with frayed copies of This Land. Thanks to the paper's large format photography, rendered in vibrant colors, it's a cheerful design choice.
So that we'll have at least ideas for the next six issues up, including the themes for the next six issues.
Aside from day-to-day management, the talk centers on two upcoming cover stories. One is an in-depth look at hydraulic fracturing, a controversial mineral extraction process that may or may not have been partially responsible for a rare earthquake that struck Oklahoma in November. The next is an investigative piece on sex abuses at a local megachurch. It's not even 10 a.m., and the editors are already taking on God and the oil and gas industry. It's hard to imagine a better way to infuriate the average conservative Oklahoman, except perhaps by openly advocating communism, an editorial position not shared by This Land, but which held considerable appeal for Oklahoma's native son Woody Guthrie, whose song, This Land Is Your Land, provides the inspiration for the publication's title.
It was born over a long discussion of Woody Guthrie and what he meant to Oklahoma.
Michael Mason is founding editor of This Land.
You know, I've been doing a lot of reading about the song itself, and came to see it as representative of a sort of new ethos that the state has adopted. It's got this very, you know, thick individualistic strain to the song, and at the same time a sort of defiance and celebration, and that's exactly what you find here in Oklahoma.
Like an alt-weekly, This Land looks like a newspaper and can be found near the register at boutiques and coffee shops. But This Land prints on 45-pound broadsheet, charges $2 per issue, and ends up being closer to a magazine in style and substance, as managing editor Mark Brown explains.
One of the joys of being a new media company is you, by definition, you operate on all formats, on all fronts. So to do print, we get to do print the way print should be done. If it's an alt-weekly, it's given away for free and they print, you know, 100,000 copies, by definition they're angling toward as cheap a product as they can get, as fast as they can get it.
Most non-traditional news-gathering operations in America, such as the all-digital Texas Tribune and MinnPost, have embraced a non-profit finance model. This land operates a foundation, but remains essentially a for-profit enterprise. Venture capitalist Vince Lavoie became this land's publisher following a substantial investment last spring.
For small businesses, small Oklahoma businesses, we created an auction where we dedicate a certain amount of space for them in our print edition. You go online and you poke around and you make a bid if you want to. And interestingly, the prices they wind up paying are not that far from the rack rate.
This land has appeared on the scene just as a decades-long effort to revive Tulsa's downtown is gathering steam. Small shops, restaurants, and bars buy most of this land's print ads, which tend to reinforce the proud localism of the editorial content. Not all staff are local, though.
I got thinking about the experience of traveling.
So just, that's like too much information. It gets away from the personal story.
This land's audio producer, Abby Wendell, tried out a journalism career in New York, but ended up as secretary at a doctor's office before moving across the country to Oklahoma on a hunch.
What I really wanted to do was go into the middle of the country, just go west, young lady, and find stories and start actually building a career that I was proud of. And I wanted to figure things out for myself. I wanted to have more room to experiment, to make mistakes, to innovate. This is a great time to be innovative in journalism. You know, maybe the Wild West is the place to do that, right?
Each print issue of This Land includes a roundup of video and audio content available online. Stories can be adapted to the most suitable platform or told across all of them. Founding editor Michael Mason says the best example yet of a cross-platform story appeared in what he calls the Tate Brady issue.
It was a story about a founder of Tulsa who was recently revealed to have been a Klansman and involved in the torturing of union members. This is a pretty scandalous story around town because nobody had ever questioned this man's identity, and he was an esteemed civic father of sorts. And not only did we publish this 5,000-word article on his life, but we created several podcasts. So all of these things sort of lined up perfectly. And the whole experience from the reader side was that there was a week in Tulsa where essentially This Land dominated the conversation in the media world.
Publisher Vince Lavoie.
Our ambition, our aspiration is to be the most reliable media voice in the middle of America. And I think part of that involves opening some minds and opening some conversations that have been closed for too long. I think on a larger scale, and this sounds grandiose, but it is an aspiration, and that is to help redefine journalism.
We conclude our talk of cutting-edge journalism with an office tour, and I'm momentarily surprised to see a traditional Plains Indian tent set up behind the office. Editor Michael Mason explains.
We have a teepee in our backyard that's about 24 feet high, I would say. It's got a big Oklahoma flag right in the front of it. If you step inside, it's a nice place to have meetings, that sort of thing.
This land is your land.
It's fitting that This Land expresses its new goals for journalism with old Oklahoma symbols. They suggest the pioneer spirit that existed here long before the state became associated with oil and big business. Woody Guthrie would likely approve. For Monocle, I'm Shepard Laughlin in Tulsa.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We're off to a teeny-weeny opening in Tokyo just after this.
Avant-garde.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary
to see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
Every month, the Monocle shop unveils a new collection of collaborations available on monocle.com and in our shops in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, and Osaka. This month sees a range of new bags added to our collection from Porter of Japan, a new blazer from London-based designer Oliver Spencer, as well as our regular lineup of stationery, CDs, posters, and books. Pop into our shops or visit us online at shop.monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, we're all for a glass of champagne at an opening night, but it's a bit of a unique one when the gallery is so small that you can't even fit in it. We sent Kenji Hall down to a very tiny photography exhibition in Tokyo with very big ambitions.
When it comes to Tokyo real estate, small is pretty typical. But Friday's opening party for an exhibition of Ryo Owada's photographs was held in what just might be one of the city's smallest art spaces, a storefront display window. The space belongs to jewelry retailer HP France, and it faces the entrance hall on the ground floor of Marunouchi Building in Tokyo's main business district. Only 5 of Owada's works were on display, and most people who showed up sipped their champagne and admired the photographs outside the shop. The smallness of the space matched the theme of Owada's photographs, bonsai trees. He shot images of these miniature, artistically pruned trees against a gold backdrop. They resembled traditional Japanese folding screens found in palaces and castles during the country's feudal period.
This exhibit shines a spotlight on bonsai trees that I spent about a year photographing. I originally wanted to capture images of pine trees, and there were several Japanese-style paintings that served as my inspiration. But I had to first learn about bonsai and began interviewing experts in the field, asking about the art of shaping trees and why some were so treasured. While I was doing this, I began photographing the bonsai trees in different seasons and different weather over a period of 1 year to see how their appearance would change. Some of these trees are several hundreds of years old and famous specimens. I used a gold background, and I also borrowed some of the ideas and proportions that artists who painted Japanese folding screens and sliding doors relied on to come up with the framing of my own photographs. Each image is actually made from several images that have been fused together. When I thought about what was so special about the bonsai, I felt it would be better to showcase them in a collage rather than just with one shot. I photographed each tree on sunny days, rainy days, in spring, summer, and winter, at different times of day and a different lighting to bring out their best characteristics, their shape, and their beauty.
Owada is an up-and-coming talent who has won praise for his work overseas. His photographs were part of a 2005 exhibition that was shown around the world and organized by the Musée de l'Élysée in Lausanne, Switzerland. He also took second place at the PX3, a prestigious photography competition in Paris. And in 2011, Owada won the Photographic Society of Japan's Best New Photographer Award. And yet, many Japanese still don't think of photographs as art. Here's Tomo Harada, the founder of Tokyo Photo, an annual art photography show.
I think this time people might have a hard time understanding this as an art form because, you know, it looks like a traditional Japanese print. We have many people who are interested in looking at photography as like in photo books or in magazines or on website, and a lot of people take photographs, and there are many good photographers here, but in general, photography is not being seen as a form of art. It's not common for people to have or exhibit photographs in their homes or much less buying photography. It's a new concept actually, but I think, you know, fashion shop like this, having a photo exhibition can bring the awareness, and I'm sure catches many people's attention.
I think it's unusual that it's still not seen as an art form, and yet, you know, Japan has produced some amazing photographers.
It's true.
Like Sugimoto Hiroshi.
Yes.
Like Moriyama Daido.
Moriyama Daido, yes. These people are phenomenal, yes. Photography to us is much like air and water. People just take it for granted. A lot of people say, well, who's going to buy a photograph? You know, anybody can take photography, you know. But, you know, seeing a good exhibition like this can change the, you know, mind of people, I think.
For Monocle, this is Kenji Hall in Tokyo.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Well, we're at the end of the show now, and it's time for everyone's favourite 60 seconds of incredibly random sound. In keeping with our storytelling theme, we decided to invite the kings of the condensed narrative, the Reduced Shakespeare Company, to tell a story in a minute for us. But not content with that task, they decided to create the single greatest sports movie of all time. And here's how it sounds.
A young boy from New Jersey moves to California, where he doesn't fit in, and gets beaten up by bullies when he talks to one of their girlfriends. An elderly Japanese gardener jumps into the fray and beats up the bullies, then teaches the young boy the power of nonviolence so that he too can beat the crap out of people. The old man dies, and the boy is recruited to play on a sad sack little league team by an alcoholic coach who hates kids. Meanwhile, down the road, a struggling, apparently schizophrenic corn farmer hears voices in his head telling him to build a baseball diamond in the middle of his cornfield. Soon, a series of impossible events occur. Dead ballplayers arrive, the farmer plays catch with his long-deceased father, Brian sings his song, and four Rastafarians slide in on a toboggan. But across the country in Philadelphia, a washed-up boxer gets a shot at the heavyweight title through a series of far-fetched coincidences. He falls in love with the ugliest girl in town, who becomes the most beautiful girl in town the moment she removes her glasses. The boxer runs up the steps of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, shouts, "Show me the Monet," and wins an Oscar. The boxer, the farmer, and the kid all train together by running on the beach in slow motion to an inspirational song. Inspired by the drunken coach, the baseball team wins the championship, but the kid is stricken with an incurable, debilitating disease. He gives a moving speech saying he's the luckiest guy on the face of the earth and is promptly euthanized by Clint Eastwood. The end.
If they could talk any faster, they'd get a job on Monocle 24. That was the Reduced Shakespeare Company's Complete World of Sports, Abridged, which they're touring across the US this spring and the UK later in the year. There's more about their tour on their website. So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be asking, what's the point of critics? You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilbao. My studio producer was Holly Fisher. And my researcher was Hannah Jenkins. Time for one final song this week from a record of the week by AM and Sean Lee, Celestial Electric. This is Somebody Like You. Thanks for tuning in. Don't you know that I need some-